Bruce Ferry. I'm so excited to meet you today. Dr. Bruce Ferry is a well-known author and psychiatrist who leads the Child Academy, Trauma Academy in Houston, Texas. He's the writer of several books, The Boy That Was Raised as a Dog, here in Dutch, and Born for Love. He has served as a consultant and expert witness on many high-profile incidents involving traumatized children in America. He's researching the long-term effects of trauma in children, adolescents, and adults. And he knows how to explain the complex theory of effects on the brain in a very simple way. And even more importantly, how you can heal trauma in these brains. He's a writer of more than 200 journal articles, book chapters, and scientific proceedings, and has received many professional awards. It's a great honor that I can personally thank you from my family and many other parents of traumatized children. I've learned so much from you about attachment and trauma and how to deal with it, but also how to see it in this world. I like the stuff what you say about the relational poverty in the Western society and that we have no clue what it does to the brains of our children. So I hope you stay on your mission to make it more and more known, because I think it's so important. Now, you received many awards, but I think the best rewards are the results of your work in the wounded hearts of our traumatized children. I know that so many parents, they're fighting to get the right care, or they get tools that not work with children or make things worse. So I hope we can use our time to take a look on the practical side of trauma and attachment. And so maybe we can help the parents to maybe implement new success tools and help them a little bit in their daily life dealing with traumatized children. So thank you again for taking the time to be with me. And maybe we can start by asking you, what is trauma?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say thank you, Esther. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm looking forward to talking with you about all of this stuff. And I, as you know, and I think as everybody else who's listening knows, in a relatively brief period of time, and we will have a conversation, we'll go back and forth, we'll talk about some things, but the in the end, what I want people to remember is that just about everything I bring up and talk about, there are other places, either in our resources online or other books or other professionals, where you can get a little bit of a deeper dive into these concepts. And so I hope people kind of just think about this almost like an infomercial, just to give people a little bit of hope that there are ways to understand how human beings work, how the brain works, how the brain changes, that should leave parents struggling with the child to be hopeful, because what we do know is that, no matter what part of the brain we're talking about, change is possible. And no matter how...
I'm so happy you say that.
Yeah, well, it's very true. And I think one of the challenges that's happened in... One of the things that happens with a lot of our therapeutic approaches is that they're not getting to the parts of the brain or the networks in the brain that are causing the problems. And I think once people step back and think a little bit about neurodevelopment, neuroplasticity, and think about, in some cases, that what would be considered unconventional approaches, you then begin to see that there's a reason why all this hard work and interventions have made minimal progress. And it's because you're not addressing the part of the brain that is involved in the functional deficit.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
And how come that, like, at one point parents know about it and then the regular care still don't know about it?
Yeah. And you mentioned this in the introduction, that one of the hardest things, I think, is that even though there's this hopeful biology. I mean, we know that people can change. Most of our systems are not designed to take advantage of those potentials. And so many of the things that we do and that are part of the mainstream educational practice, mainstream therapeutic practice, are not effective for these kids that we work with that are impacted by very, you know, particularly early attachment experience, you know, problems.
And, yeah.
Now the field is changing, it's getting better, but you know, in the US and other places, I mean, we have colleagues all over the world and who are, you know, we're all learning from each other. But most of us, you know, when we talk about the rest of the community that we're part of, you know, only a fraction of the practitioners understand these things.
Yeah, but is it very difficult to understand, or don't they get access to the right information? Because I understand it as a parent, because I started looking for my daughter.
Yeah. So, well, here the part of the dilemma, and I've written a little bit of a commentary about this, but part of the dilemma is that once people in any discipline, let's take the discipline of medicine, once they develop their view of the world, once they think things work a certain way, and then a new idea comes along, it doesn't matter what the idea is. The initial response is to ignore it, because anything that challenges the way they do things, they just ignore. But then if it gets to the point where you can't ignore it, then they attack it. And so they'll attack people that are using these new ideas. And then ultimately they'll do what we call co-op. They'll bring the ideas in and they'll claim that these are their ideas, and, you know, which is fine. But
it sounds familiar. Yeah. Yeah.
And that happens in all systems. That happens in all systems and in all change, really. But the sad reality for families and for kids is that that process takes about 20 years. And so if you look at, and people have done research on this, that you can establish a best practice, a new innovation, and have it proven scientifically, but it takes about 20 years before that new thing becomes standard of practice. And so you sort of were struggling, you know, again, you mentioned that you have a child who had some issues.
Yeah.
So you sort of were in this unfortunate time when you started looking for help. Probably nobody knew about this. And very, very few people were in a position to go, oh, I understand what's going on and let's do this. And so, like many parents that we run into, you kind of go from one clinician to another and you sort of seek out helpful things. And one person says it's this and another person says that. And it's very confusing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. In my search for answers for my daughter, it took me to the States.
Oh, really?
It took me to, Healing Heart. Do you know Nancy Thomas?
I do. Oh, I mean, yes. I don't know her, but I know of that work. Yeah.
That's how I got to know about we always call it the 6 R's of Bruce Perry, you know, so one of your tools. That's how I got to know your knowledge. I go back every year and help to contribute what she did for my child. And I help on those Healing Heart camps. She does these attachment camps.
Oh.
And I'm like, the knowledge is there. The vision is there. But we need to, like, expand it. Yeah,
very true.
And that goes slow, especially for the parents that are really struggling.
But let me just give you a flavor of the thing that we do. That.
Yeah, because the feedback I often get from parents is, yeah, it's nice, the story about the relational poverty and the Western society, but my child is peeing in his closet every night, or my child is, he or she can't eat, he throws up. The practical stuff from the trauma, the lying, the stealing, the manipulation, that makes it so hard. And also, especially the two faces, you know, to strangers, they're like angels. And at home, they are like, hard to deal with.
It's definitely, let me just pull this up here. Absolutely. You know, the specific, I didn't really explain it, but some of the, those symbols on those maps were for clinicians. Mm-hmm. Some of the symbols were for educators and schools. And then some of the symbols were for parents and caregivers. So we have a model where we teach parents about these core concepts. And a big part of that is helping them understand how to help minimize some of these behavioral problems in the household. It, because if you don't, you know, these kids can be very, very, very challenging to parent.
Yeah.
And it leads to exhaustion and demoralization. And, you know, sometimes parents just, you know, their own mental health suffers in significant ways. It's really hard to deal with some of these kids.
Yeah, exactly. But if you would be my therapist and I come to you and I say, okay, my child is stealing all the time, my child is lying all the time, how would you start to help me? Where does that start?
Here's what I would start is I'd say that I don't understand why they do that, but if we do a developmental history and do this assessment, we may get some clues about where to, you know, how to start dealing with this in a way that's going to lead to some change. And so, again, let me just switch to this and just show you. Part of what we do is we do what we call psychoeducation.
Yeah.
So we try to teach the parent a little bit about why we are going to make some recommendations. Because if I talk to a parent and I came in and said, listen, you know, they're lying, they're stealing, and what you need to do is make sure they go for long walks and get to jump on the trampoline. They look at me like, they look at me like, what?
Yeah.
You're crazy. And then they just leave.
Yeah. Well, that's the challenge that I have, because I know what it means because I did it. I mean, I have the trampoline in my office. I had it many years downstairs. There it is. I was on it before I was meeting you. I had it in my, you know, I had my whole living room trauma informed because I got it. And then I could heal my child so much. I want to pass your knowledge on. I want to pass the knowledge from the Healing Heart Cats on. But people are looking at me like I'm crazy, exactly like you said.
Right.
Maybe you can explain this now.
So this is what we try to do. We try to help people understand the reason that we would make these recommendations.
Yeah.
And so we start with, this is our, you know, the most common basic, we call it a heuristic, but just think of it as a model. It's a cartoon. And it really is just trying to show two things. The first thing is that the brain is organized kind of from bottom to top. And the top part of the brain is where you do your thinking. You know, the top part of the brain is where speech and language and values and telling right from wrong, all of that is up in the cortex.
Yeah.
And as you go lower in the brain, you kind of get to these simpler regulatory functions.
Yeah.
Now, the second thing that we wanted to show people is that there are these really, really important regulatory networks that originate in the lower part of the brain and then spread out to every part of the body and to every part of the brain. And because of this important, we call it microarchitecture, because these systems go everywhere, these become the backbone of our stress response. And so if you have incoming input, let's say, you know, from the outside world that says, oh, there's a saber-toothed tiger, it comes into this right down to that alarm, low part of the brain, it sends an alarm signal to those networks I just mentioned. And then they go and turn off certain parts of the brain and turn on other parts of the brain and body to help you get ready for threat. And now there's a couple things that are really important here. The first one is that all of your sensory input, every time, you know, when you're looking at me and you see me on this computer screen and you hear me, that information goes to the lowest part of your brain first. And so the lowest part of your brain basically gets the first choice on processing that information. And so if there's, let's say when you were a young child, somebody who had a voice like mine was always yelling and cruel to your mother. And so all, and that would, when your brain was developing and very young, your brain would have made an association, a connection between a sound of a tone of voice like I have and threat. And so 30, 40 years later, you could hear somebody speaking and not even be aware of the fact that that person, for whatever reason, makes your skin crawl.
Yeah.
And you, this part of your brain, the thinking part of your brain, would go, I wonder why, I can't figure, why don't I like this? And you'd search for some reason why you don't like the person. But the reality is you had the feeling before you had the thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what we talk, we call this, our model is the neuro, that's sort of, you know, that's signifying that we're trying to use this neuroscience lens. And then sequential, and that's basically acknowledging that the brain develops sequentially, the brain processes information sequentially, and we think that you have to do your therapeutic work sequentially. And so back to that original question about what would I do? So what we've developed this process that what we do is we've created a way to get a little bit of, now do you see a big, one big screen, or do you see my?
No, I see a big screen and we are little in the, on the side.
Little ones. Okay, yeah. I'm gonna go ahead and swap that.
Okay.
So now you should see a big screen, right? I hope. Do you see the slide?
And now it's smaller. Now, before the-
It was
the,
better before?
Okay. Yeah, it was better before, yeah.
Okay, let me do this. That's better?
Yeah.
Okay. So what we've done is we've taken a bunch of functions that are really, you know, fine motor skills tell you about parts of the brain, and, you know, sleep tells you about another part of the brain, and impulsivity tells you about another part of the brain. And so we were able to create basically a map of somebody's brain. And this, for example, is a child who had profound early life neglect and attachment problems. And he was adopted. And he was misunderstood by the mainstream systems. And so this is the way a regular 11 to 13-year-old would be organized. All of these capabilities would be pretty well normal or pretty organized. That's all this green stuff. And this is the way he was organized. And part of what happened was, and this is the narrative of what happens with so many kids like this, is that when he was 4 or 5 years old, he acted like he was 18 months old. He'd have temper tantrums. He wouldn't listen. He'd have meltdowns. He was touch aversive. People tried to touch him, and he didn't find that comforting. He found that escalating and dysregulating. And I think anybody who's worked with these kids or raised them knows what I'm talking about. And yeah. And so they sent him off, and he got a whole bunch of different labels. And they used the regular treatment approach, and none of it worked. And he just got bigger and bigger and bigger and scarier and scarier. Yeah. And they put him in residential, and then they put him in psychiatric hospitals, and they finally sent him off to a place in that we work with in New Mexico. And they were just learning to use this model, this neurosequential model. And basically what we did was we look at, all right, well, here's where his strengths are, these greens, and his vulnerabilities are all these pinks and red areas, which means that he's struggling in really even in the lowest part of his brain, he's got really undeveloped regulatory capabilities. So it is true that he's got problems up here with speech and language and impulsivity and logic and all that other stuff. But until we address these problems first, mm-hmm. we're never going to solve these problems up here.
Yeah.
So we started with very regulatory, pattern, repetitive, rhythmic, somatosensory stuff. And it took about a year, but he got to this point. And at this point, he was able to tolerate being in parallel relationships. And then we sort of, we continued to do some of these regulatory things, but then we added in more
relationships. And for the viewers, when you say regulatory repetitional things.
Yeah. I mean, things like walking, he would groom a horse.
He would
spackle, and paint, and he did, gardening, but all of that stuff is pattern, repetitive motor activity.
Yeah.
And so he did a lot of those things that from a distance, if you looked at his day, you'd go, this kid gets up, he walks over there, he walks a mile, he paints on the barn, he milks a goat, he weeds the garden, he walks back to lunch. How is that therapeutic?
Yeah.
But again, believe me, I had to reassure the staff because they were used to, they were used to, let's sit down and talk and I'm going to change you. And the truth is, talking is a wonderful thing. But when you have a newborn baby and you talk about Einstein's theory of relativity to the baby, if you do it in this tone of voice, the baby feels, will look at you and coo and make sounds, but the content of your words means nothing to the infant. All the infant hears is the prosody, the rhythm, the tone, the sweetness in your voice. And so you could be talking complete garbage. And so to the infant, it's the regulatory rhythm that is changing the lower parts of the brain. And as they get more mature and these systems come on board, then the words begin to have meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, they have meaning, the rhythm and the relational interactions gives them meaning. And so we started with regulatory stuff and then relational stuff. And then ultimately we got to the part of the brain that can reason, that can think. And so by this time we were doing talk. Talk was part of the therapeutic process.
Mm-hmm.
But if you'd started here talking to him about what's right and what's wrong and you need to do this and these are the rules, it's like talking to a wall. He just wouldn't process it. And so this is what we would do. We'd say, all right, let's figure out where your child is, this is a 15-year-old girl who was in the juvenile justice system and they had severe attachment problems and they were ready to put her in solitary confinement. And we were able to convince the court not to do that, to actually put her in a relational environment where she could be in parallel with people and that they knew how to do, just how to not escalate her. And literally what they did for the first few months here was with this girl is just walk around the town.
Yeah.
She didn't want to be at that place. She wanted to walk to the mall. She wanted to see her friends. And a staff member just walked with her and just made sure that when she was with her friends, she'd smoke cigarettes or whatever. They didn't do anything criminal. And then she'd walk back. And then she walked around there. And so literally they'd walk 4 or 5 hours a day. But it was pattern, repetitive, rhythmic activity. And pretty soon she got to the point where she wanted to talk with the staff member. And then she told the staff member all kinds of, important things about her dreams and her hopes. And it evolved into a more traditional therapeutic interaction. But it started with regulation.
As simple as a walk and not... pushing them into talking, because most of them, they hate to talk because it's mostly about what did you do wrong and this is what you should do.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And again, I can absolutely understand why parents would focus on, they're stealing. Oh, they called me a name. Oh, they, and one of the hardest things is to calm make a parent feel safe with you as the therapist to the point where they can hear you.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that, again, I hate to turn this into like a lecture, but again, one of the things that we know very well, and I'll do this the easy way. Can you see this?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll make this a little bit bigger, but so what we know is when you're calm, you have access to the top part of your brain, you know, your cortex. You can think and you can reason and if you want to talk to your child about something, this would be the ideal state. However, many of the kids that we work with, because they've had a history of trauma, this is their baseline state. They have not that much of their cortex activated. And, you know, when we do talk to them, it gets short-circuited as it gets up, tries to get to the cortex. In fact, one of the things they do is they distort. I don't know if I have this in here somewhere. They distort what we are saying. So, you know, here's one of the biggest challenges with working with these kids is that we all have these internal, I guess I'd call them filters, you know, so we all have them. And if somebody, and here's the dilemma of communication. Let me just make this big because it's, if I can figure out how to do this. Oh, here we go. Okay. So here's the dilemma of communication. Let's say here's a parent and they have something up in their cortex and they want to get that information about what's right and wrong into this person's cortex. The problem is, that information has to go through the emotional part of your brain and then through the dumb part of your brain, because this part of the brain is very categorical, out into space, up through the dumb part of the child's brain, through their emotional filters, up to their cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of room for miscommunication. Let's say this is a child who had a history of relational rejection. And a parent says something neutral, like, we just want to talk. When you say that to the child, their brain goes, oh, they want to talk. They don't like me. I did something wrong. What did I do wrong? Right?
This reminds me of my boy, very well and safe attached, but he's in puberty now.
Yeah.
So even if you say good morning, what?
Yeah, really, why?
Yeah.
And what do you want?
Exactly. Yeah, I get it, yeah.
And then if you are a parent and you're frustrated, and what will happen is, even though you're not intending to convey your frustration, it's impossible to hide. And so they hear the frustration in your voice, and now they go, oh, they hate me. They're going to kick me out. And so these distorting filters are very, very common in kids that have developmental trauma.
Yeah, yeah.
And so communication is very challenging if the child's not regulated.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I'm sorry, I'm kind of going on.
No, yeah, I hope it's information that the parents can integrate so they understand it better, and also understand better why it's more important to stay active. Because I find it always very hard to explain, instead of, like, you know, punishment. Like you said, go for a walk, go play some football, or go on the trampoline. But this is the key. Now you backed it up with science.
Well, when you go teach, I'm going to throw this out there because I think this is probably the case. Many of these parents are so overwhelmed that they want very simple, kind of concrete, tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Like there's going to be a simple one thing to do or two things.
Yeah.
And I think one of the hardest balancing acts is hearing them, you know, hearing that, you know, I understand you feel that you're like this, it's completely understandable. And then calming them to the point where they can actually feel a little regulated themselves. And and I didn't really say this, but one of the things that's really important about having your getting your cortex open is that the cortex is a part of the brain that can tell time.
Oh, yeah.
And hope, your ability to be hopeful, is up in the cortex. And so the more dysregulated a parent gets, the less hopeful they will become.
Mm-hmm.
And the more they'll be focused on the immediate. I want him to do this. We have to solve these problems soon. But if you can regulate a parent or somebody who's or a teacher and help them understand that this is a process, that they may be 15, but they're developmentally like a four-year-old. And if you kind of meet them, you know, if you have expectations that you would have of a normal four-year-old, they'll be able to meet those expectations. Yeah. And you'll have more positive experiences, and you'll get on sort of a virtuous cycle where the more the child feels like they've done something well, the more likely they're going to try again. And this is what we find with so many of these kids, is that they've failed at so many things.
Yeah.
That they don't even want to try.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a heartbreaking thing, I think. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's that is one of the reasons that I started to organize, I call it Inspiration Days, because I am a mother myself of a traumatized child. But what I want is to get parents together. I know a little bit more than they do. I share a little bit, but what I want to do is that they can give each other a cuddle, and you're in it just like me, and I am not crazy. Very often they walk in a room and they say, oh, it's normal people in here. They think that, you know, when you have a traumatized kid, you must be a very, very bad parent. And that was also one of the reasons that I said, you know what, I'm going to go into publicity, and, you know, this is me, this is my family, because I was so lonely. If you, at one point, as a mother of a traumatized child, you're so isolated because you can't go anywhere with your kid because you have a funny kid. And if you have a funny kid, I wrote it in my book that when you have a funny kid, you're funny too. And if your kid doesn't have play dates, you're not going to have friendships. So it's so big for a whole family and a whole system when you have a traumatized kid. Yeah. And I think that needs to change too, because I felt for so many years I'm the worst mom in the world. My child doesn't like me. She cannot even hold me. I had to wait like 13 years to hold her hand, you know. And I thought I was the only one. And that, I think that should that should change. That the parents, they, and I want to tell them when they watch this video, it's not your fault and it's nobody's fault. And there's hope. That's what I want to share and spread.
And there is hope. And I think it's interesting. There are parents who have kids that are well-regulated, you know, for whatever reason, you know, whether it's genetic or they had a great combination of genetics and intrauterine, and who knows. But even a relatively impaired parent can look very competent if the child has sort of one of these well-regulated temperaments. You know, I've been that parent of, you know, I've got five kids. Now they're all adults, but when our first child was like a really one of these incredible kids, right? And so I'm thinking, oh, we're so good at parenting. And then our second child was like, you know, I love her, but oh my God, it was, she was so, you know, nothing we did with the oldest child worked with the second child. And she was always dysregulated. And we thought, wow, now we're shitty parents. Like, and neither one of those were true, right? We weren't great and we weren't terrible. Yeah. We were just average parents.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is absolutely true. As a parent, you feel shamed if your child isn't doing well. And it becomes an inhibition to reaching out for help for you. And it really collapses the world of your family, right? So you just don't,
But the thing is also that if your child has diabetes, another kind of disease, you don't see it, but everybody's like, oh, shall I cook dinner? Can I take care of you? But if your child has a mental challenge,
right,
everybody steps back. And I sometimes told people, my child was in an institute for 2 years. Oh, but she's always so nice. Yeah, to you. But when she's in the home, she sometimes has meltdowns for 45 minutes. Yeah. And that was just like very, very hard for people. Like I am now on the other side, you know. I had the opportunity to get all the knowledge and to, I had to quit working. I had a nice job, but I stopped working to be there for the kid, my daughter. But a lot of parents don't have that freedom and opportunity.
Exactly.
Life is a struggle. And I feel like we have so much money in Holland to spend. Spend it on when they're young. I think because I look at your videos all the time, and you also say every dollar spent before a certain age is 10 times more when they are in puberty. They don't look like that towards eight for the kids.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, one of the things I think that's very positive about what you're doing is the destigmatizing of all of these issues. You know, people are fearful of what they don't understand. And so I think the more people like you help educate the public and your peers about what these issues are and what they aren't, I think the next generation of parents will have it easier. But it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of public engagement to destigmatize these concepts. There are people, you know, mental health globally, you know, it's probably the number one draw on any economy is depression, anxiety, you know, just like your example, you had to quit the workforce to deal with the mental health issues.
Yeah.
And when they monetize all of this stuff, it's actually, of all the diseases there are, mental health issues are by far the largest drain on any Western society's economy. And so I think, again, in my lifetime, I've seen things shift a little bit, but we have a long way to go. And so I think what you're doing is really important.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's not easy, because sometimes when I go in like a magazine for an interview, people have a very strong opinion about what I do. And it's sometimes hard for my family. But I'm like, this is my mission in life. This is what I have to do.
You're going to love Tony. Tony's awesome. And you should get those guys to help you with this because they're both good communicators. They're embedded in the systems. I think they'd be helpful in this process for you.
I hope so. Yeah.
So how many people do you have in, you know, at sort of the network that you have?
I have like a community. I just started blogging a few years ago. Like, this is my life. This is my story. And I started writing. I never thought that somebody would ever read my blogs, but then it grew very quickly. And now I have like more than 5,000 people who are following me. And I never thought it was going to be that big for such a small country, maybe not for the States, but for Holland. And from there, it became my business. From there, I started making events so the parents could come together. And from there, people invite me to come speak for adoption and foster care, and now also more into the government. So I keep my fingers crossed, because that's where I want to be, share my story there, share my knowledge there. And I just started a few years ago, so I'm still at the beginning.
As I mentioned, one of the branches of this model that we have is targeted towards non-professional parents or people who work with these kids. And so we have some content that you may find helpful, and I'll talk with Tony and Roland about trying to help you get access to some of that stuff and use in your work.
Yeah, because now I'm also starting to work with funding from the government. Because what you probably know, but in the United States, you have intensives where you go a few days or a week into a parent's home. Yeah. Because what I think the system is so weird, when I was getting the intense care, you go to a certain office, probably maybe you work the same way too, but you go to an office, strange room, you talk about what went right, what went good, you get tips and you go home. Hmm. But for me, it's like, and I did that in the States, I went to Nancy Thomas for a week and I went with my family to the camp. You get an aid in the 24/7 care. And that's what I do already a little bit in Holland, where I go to families. You need me at 7 in the morning, I'll be there at 7 in the morning. And I look at the whole system. Because very often when everybody is in a room, they talk from their perception. But you have blind spots as a parent. You know, very often parents use way too many words or not the right words.
Well, don't say very often. You should say always. Parents always use too many words.
And then you can guide them. You're like, we have like signs like that, or we text with the parents, like, you know, you have an emoji like that. So you can guide them almost. Do you know the super nanny in England?
Program? Yeah.
Well, she doesn't have the trauma-informed tools, but that's the way that I work. I have the honor to work with certain families, that you can almost be like the shadow of the of the mother and look in the family as a system where they are, and then you just observe. And from there, you can guide them much better when they're all in the room talking about what went wrong this
exactly week. You know, that's very similar to a therapeutic approach called PCIT, where you have a parent and a child that are interacting, playing. Now, usually is in an office setting.
Yeah.
But the therapist is behind a one-way mirror watching, and then they talk to the parent and they go, you may want to not say so many words now. Yeah. That kind of thing.
Or use more facial expression. Like some parents, they're like, there's nothing there.
Or they'll try to communicate with their child across the room by yelling. You know,
Exactly.
Is a very common thing. As kids get older, we sort of use those techniques and we forget that, you know, you really should engage the child, you know, make sure that they're connected to you, and then talk with them. I mean, as I showed before, communication is hard enough, even when you do have somebody's attention. So that's interesting. We've actually moved away from office-based therapy in large part for the reasons you're talking about. We like to do home visits. We like to have people in homes. We like to teach and engage a lot of the people in the child's world, including the teachers and the grandparents. And if everybody kind of has a fundamental understanding, it makes everything so much better.
Yeah. Now, and I ask also the parents, where are your biggest struggle? Oh, when I go with nieces to the play yard, I go with them to the play yard, because how can you solve the problem when you're in an office? I go there, and then you can see what the mother is not seeing, and from there you can guide.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I've been reading all the books. I've been watching all your videos like 100 times, or listening to it to get the right trauma knowledge. But from there, you just have to be practical. And I find, and also a lot of parents that are coming to me, they cannot find the practical tools.
Right.
Like how we started the conversation, the lying, the stealing. That I learned also a lot from Nancy Thomas. Do you know this therapy, paradoxic parenting? Well, it's not therapy, but it's a different way of looking at certain things. Like I always
know a little bit about it. Yeah.
When I talk, like, a lot of parents hate it when they scream the most worst things to you. I always tell them, dismantle them like secret weapons. I'm trying to translate now. Because you can put so much effort on the screaming, or you can say, oh, you want to do this with your mother? Or, that's a disease. And then I always, let me see, I have my own attachment monster. I'll show it to you. Because I always want to tell parents, when they show the behavior, it's the attachment monster. It's not the child. And I remember it so well when my daughter was 10 years, I told her, when you acting out, it's not you, it's the attachment monster, the hechtingsmonster. I saw in my child, oh, so it's not my fault. So that's why I always have this as a, you could say, metaphor. I always tell them, it's not your child, it's the monster coming out, the attachment monster. And parents love it because they feel like, ah, I can like take it, yeah, the bad behavior, what gives me such a bad feeling, and they feel bad about it, or they have the strong feelings about it. I said, but that's not the authentic child, that's the attachment monster. So that's what I do.
I like that. I like it. In many ways, it's similar to the psychoeducational thing that we do. We try to help people understand that it's that if there is a overly reactive system in this child's brain, that's what's going to get them in trouble. And it's not that they're a bad person. It's not that they're intending to be impulsive, aggressive. They can't help it. They're reactive. And again, once you can sort of take these interactions and help both the parent and the child understand that this isn't a personal thing. The shame that kids feel after they blow up and they've done something, they feel so shamed. And then that leads to all of these other problems. Again, I think what you're doing to kind of, whatever mechanism you can use to help people understand that this is something that is not the substance of the child, and it's not the substance of you as a parent. Because the other thing that, again, I'm sure you run into is that a lot of the parents themselves are struggling. In the U.S., we do a lot of work, at least in our clinical teams all over. Many of the kids that we serve are in the child welfare system. And probably 90% of their parents were also neglected and abused when they grew up. And so we have these transgenerational challenges where, we're asking a lot of the conventional therapeutic approaches are making the default assumption that the parent is going to be able to think clearly, be on time, use executive functioning, all these other things, when they themselves are a 25-year-old who, was neglected and abused when they were growing up.
Yeah.
And so now we're asking them, the parent, and not only parent, but parent an incredibly challenging child. And so if we don't meet the needs of the parents, we rarely succeed with the child. So that's a big part of what we try to do, is recognize that there are multiple, individuals that are involved in this process, and each of them will have needs. And if we can get them all regulated, then they're in a better position to do all these positive things that can happen when people.
And do you also take in this neurotransmitter story? Because I always try to educate myself more about different topics, and now I just had a training into neurotransmitters. Like you said, when I am not well attached to my mom came from an alcoholic family, so I call it the necklace of attachment. But you can see it in behavior and challenges. But it's also, I don't know the translation, biochemical.
Yeah.
Like I have a different system. I have lower neurotransmitters. You know the Braverman test, right? The test where you can. I had the lowest one of my whole class. It was almost funny, but that's how I live my life already. So for so many years, I have to struggle extra because my levels are so low.
Yeah.
And I think that's also good. What I try to share my followers is that you have behavior, you have trauma-informed tools, but also look at your neurotransmitters, your hormones, the hormone systems, but also food, for example. Because I see it as a puzzle. There's more than just the trauma-informed approach.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and we, a big part of what we talk about is that if you understand the physiology of regulation, which involves sort of the regulatory capabilities of your neurotransmitter networks. It involves nutrition is a huge part of it. Physical exercise, sleep, all of these sort of regulatory elements that if you have external structure and external predictability, you have a much better chance of having internal predictability, internal regulation.
Yeah.
And so we spend a lot of time, the very simple steps can sometimes lead to huge differences. So yeah. we'll literally say, all right, we're going to prescribe 5 minutes of walking every hour.
Oh, yeah.
And think of it literally as a pill that
yeah.
when your Apple Watch buzzes and you need to get up and walk for 5 minutes and come back to your desk or come back to whatever you're doing. And that simple things like that really begin to make the parent more regulated. And then then we add on regulatory activities for the child. And so the more regulated everybody in the household is, pretty soon the household becomes regulated and it feels better. And when it feels better, people are able to be more relationally connected and feel pleasure from that.
Yeah.
And the more pleasure you can have from that, then there's this sort of, like I said, this virtuous cycle. And it's, but many, many, many of these families are in the other kind of cycle, where you come home from work and you're exhausted and frustrated and the child comes home from school and they've done poorly. And then they interact and it's like they escalate each other.
Yeah.
And it's
it's hard.
It is hard. It's very hard.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's what you also say about relational poverty, Western society and how we deal with all that and the stress and mom and dad working long hours. And yeah. That's hard, isn't it?
It is hard. I mean, we've created these environments that really put too many demands yeah. on the parent and the child.
Yeah.
And if you are lucky enough to be kind of genetically or epigenetically pretty well regulated, you can tolerate that stuff. It's not like it's good for you, but you can tolerate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you are over on the other spectrum where you have any vulnerability, you're much more likely to have struggles. And, you can see it. I mean, you can see the rise in suicidality, the rise in anxiety, the rise in depression in the Western world. And, the percentages of individuals who've had adversity, we're just really, we have a resilience-resistant culture. In other words, we've organized our society in a way that we are minimizing opportunities to build resilience.
Yeah.
So if you go back to I don't want to call it primitive, but if you go, let's say you go back to a community where there was no electronics, where there was very little mobility, 8 or 9 people lived in a single home, your grandparents lived down the street, and there was this sort of social fabric that was very densely connected. Those communities are much more likely to tolerate stressors, whether they're economic stressors or they're natural disaster stressors or they're mental health stressors, whatever they are, that community is more resilient than our typical modern society in the US. Now, and again, I've been to the Netherlands and Europe a few times. It strikes me that you guys are better than we are, you know, I think so. I mean, I think that, I do. I think that from what little I know about your culture and society, there's more physical proximity. There's better third spaces. People have more conversation. People still have meals where it will talk for 2 hours. You know, that just does not happen much in the U.S. anymore. It's the number of family meals in the average American house is less than 2 a week.
I think you mentioned that in one of your talks.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It is crazy.
And what I also think, maybe you can share your opinion about it, that the tribe of the church or religion was a part of also of bonding and attachment. Yeah,
exactly. And,
but I think in America you have more faith still than in Holland. We are like more liberal. There's not so much people go to church anymore. What is your view on that?
Well, it's interesting. I think the U.S. is becoming more secular.
Secular, that means
not connected to a church, or people identify as having a religion, but don't go to church.
Oh, okay.
Now, but I do think that a community of faith can be one of those anchors for
yeah.
people. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a hunger, I think, for many people to be connected, to feel connected to something. And I'm not sure what it is, what people are replacing church with. But I do think that people are
the phone.
Yeah, the phone.
On the phone.
Lots of people on the phone.
Oh.
But it's, I have to say, I part of me is reluctant to go after technology too much, because I think that once we learn how to manage technology, you know, we develop better sort of screen hygiene.
Yeah, I remember you.
I think that we can then take advantage of these amazing technologies. Like, look at this. You and I are having a conversation across, you know.
That's so cool, right? Yeah.
It's pretty cool, right? And and the technology is good enough that I see you, you see me, you can kind of look at facial expressions. So you get, it's very different than a phone call, right? Or a letter, or, so I do think that technologies can be used in a really positive way. But I also think that we just have to learn how to regulate.
Yeah.
We have to learn how to, put them down and not use them in certain meetings, put them down and not use them during family times, put them down and not use them when we're out on a hike. You know, if you're really out enjoying nature, don't talk on the phone. Just enjoy nature, or whatever. But
I like you. Is it your word, technical hygiene? Because I love that word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some other people may have used it, but as far as I know.
I like that word. Yeah. And you also had the reference of, like, when we had cars, first there were no rules, there was no driving license, and then at one point we learned to regulate
exactly.
to have a car in society, and we might do that with the phone too.
Yeah. No, I think that's what we have to do. I think about other big public health questions. Like, I don't want to sound crude or anything, but for the longest time in many cultures in the Western world, for example, New York or London, these big cities, people would go to the bathroom wherever they wanted to. They would literally on the street. Anywhere, or they go in their buckets and they just throw the buckets out the window, right?
Oh, okay.
So there was crap everywhere. And so once the connection was made between disease and sanitation, we decided to basically do a couple things. First of all, it was a big public engagement campaign, which took decades because people didn't believe it. People didn't believe that these diseases were connected to sewage and that washing your hands after you would, go to the bathroom was good for your health. All of that stuff took a long time to build in sort of these cultural practices around going to the bathroom. So now, kids that grow up now, it's very, we toilet train them, we teach them, well, there are places where you go to the bathroom and places where you don't go to the bathroom. And we're going to do that. We'll have to do the same thing with screens, with phones. We'll literally develop the ability to raise our kids in an environment where there are very clear expectations and rules about when you do that and when you don't. And I think that it's just a matter of will. Once there's a broad enough awareness that nonstop exposure to screens is not good for people, then we'll come up with ways to sort of regulate that.
So. And when you say that's not good for people, for brains of people, can you explain a little bit more like that? Is it because I don't know how to explain very well. Maybe you can explain why it's not good to be on the screen for too long.
Right. Well, there's a couple reasons. First one is that it turns out that if, particularly when you're young, if you're on a screen a lot, it influences the way your brain develops. Now, we don't know for sure whether that's bad, but the studies that show lots of screen time lead to changes in the brain, and then there are studies that show lots of screen time lead to increased rates of attention problem and under socialization. So those three things might be connected. Mm-hmm. So I think as more information is gathered, we'll be able to say, all right, you know, for children at certain ages, X amount of screen time is okay, but you shouldn't do that until, you know, it's like alcohol, right? So we know that if we give a developing brain alcohol, it has a worse impact than if you give a, you know, a 25-year-old alcohol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing with screens. If we have lots of screen time when the brain is rapidly organizing and developing, that's probably not good for it. And then the second problem really is that screen time is time taken away from other time. So the more you're doing screen time, the less you're understanding, you know, what a nonverbal communication is.
Yeah.
Or how do you actually have a conversation with somebody? You know, you look them in the eyes for how long? When you're having a conversation, how do you stay engaged in a way that it is, feels respectful? It helps you really hear them. You have to learn how to listen. And if we don't give children opportunities to do that by giving them repetition and repetition and repetition and repetition, they're not going to develop those capabilities. And I think that's what's happening actually now. You know, in the U.S., one of the biggest problems that we're having is that young adults are entering the workforce without the social skills to succeed. They don't know how to respectfully sit in a meeting.
Yeah.
They don't know how to engage a new client in a way that the client feels like they're, you know, being, you know, heard. They're not good at sharing. You know, all these soft skills that make you successful in life, we're developing 20, 22, 23-year-old kids that are really have the social skills of, you know, 10, 11, and 12-year-olds. So anyway, I'm ready.
Yeah, and I see that also in my with my son. You have three, four boys in a room. They're all like this.
Yeah.
But the parents are struggling because it's new to us too. Yeah. We didn't invent the rules yet, like with being outside in a bucket.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, what time do we start? Did we start?
At 4 o'clock. Oh. Okay. Yes.
So,
thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, and I'd be happy to do this again at some point. You know, we can, you know, talk to Tony, talk to Roland.
I will say hello.
Learn a little bit about what they're doing, and I think we're happy to support what you're doing. I think it's great.
Thank you so much. Thank you.